Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
From base camp to the healthcare reform summit.
Show me what you got, but don't let the American people go another year, another 10 years, another 20 years without health insurance reform in this country.
Obama interrupts his administration already in progress for a special presentation, a trip to Mount Healthcare. It's up there in the gridlock range, near the cliffs of political inertia, where he hopes to hear more than just some bad echoes.
Go tell it on the mountain, over the hills, never be away.
From the top of the mountain, all roads lead down. Yikes. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. He's back. It's Thursday, February 25th. Good morning, Celeste.
He's back and he's mad. Children under 17, not admitted without an adult.
The takeaway is, how much of a risk is this health care reform summit in Washington for the administration and for the Republicans?
Is it a risk? I don't think of it as a risk. I think of it as kind of a showy thing.
We shall see if it can get anything done.
Let's get right to the top stories this morning. Toyota's president faced the music on Capitol Hill.
I'd first like to state that I love cars as much as anyone, and I love Toyota as much as anyone.
But members of the House Oversight Committee pressed on yesterday, wanting to know when Toyota knew about the safety problems that have been linked to 34 deaths and what the company did about it. Akio Toyota didn't respond to that directly, but he did apologize.
I am deeply sorry for any accident that Toyota drivers have experienced.
Toyota insisted the problem is not with the car's electronic system, something that U.S. safety regulators dispute. In other auto news, the end of the road for Hummers. A deal by General Motors to sell the brand to a Chinese firm has fallen through, so GM is winding the Hummer brand down.
Toyota executives weren't the only ones under fire on the Hill yesterday. The health insurance company WellPoint was in the hot seat for its decision to hike premiums up to 39% in California. WellPoint executives told Congress the rate hikes are justified by soaring medical costs. Now, all of this sets the stage for this morning's summit on health care reform that I spoke about moments ago. President Obama, 22 influential congressional Democrats and Republicans will be together in one room for 6 hours with the cameras rolling and the snow falling, apparently, in Washington, D.C. We're joined by Jonathan Cohn, senior editor at The New Republic. Jonathan, good morning.
Good morning.
So, Jonathan, is this summit, pageant, Supreme Court of public opinion, whatever you want to call it, a sign of desperation on the part of the administration, or could it be the seed of a new initiative?
Actually, I think neither. I think this is a chance to finish the work on the comprehensive bill they've been spending more than a year working on already.
Well, we will talk about what the constitutional implications of appealing to a court of public opinion is for the Obama administration and what is likely to come out of this in just a moment.
A killer whale at Orlando's SeaWorld has killed its trainer in front of a horrified audience. That happened yesterday. Witnesses say the whale snatched the trainer off the platform and held her underwater in its jaws, drowning her.
U.S. officials are calling it a new beginning for one city in Afghanistan as several hundred residents looked on. The red, black, and green flag of Afghanistan was raised this morning over the former Taliban stronghold of Marja. At the Olympics, the U.S. men's hockey team beat Switzerland 2-0 while Canada ran over Russia 7-3. The U.S. took two bronze medals, including Erin Pack in the women's bobsled.
It doesn't feel real yet because we don't have it in our hands, but I'm just so excited.
Oh, yeah. The medal count now stands at the U.S. with 28, Germany with 24 catching up, followed by Norway with 18. More on the games with the New York Times Olympics editor in 20 minutes. Asian markets are down. European indices are mixed. Futures are down. The Dow gets underway at 10,374. The S&P at 1,105. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,235. Coming up, a new project with our home station WNYC. We look at transportation around the country.
And we continue our series, Frustration Nation, as well. President Obama is hosting a bipartisan health care summit. What do you think it'll take to get the two parties working together, cooperating? Can it be done? What'll it take? 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to our website, thetakeaway.org. We're going to talk more about that healthcare summit in just a moment.
You're You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. As the snow begins to fall in Washington, D.C., there are at least, by my count, 25, 26 or so people in Washington who will have a reason to stay indoors for 6 hours that has nothing whatsoever to do with the snow.
Absolutely nothing, unless one of them slips and breaks a bone.
Right, and God forbid that that would happen. Right. But at about 10 o'clock Eastern Time, the Healthcare Reform Summit convenes to live television cameras as the president gathers with prominent Democrats and Republicans to try to hammer out in public some sort of compromise on healthcare reform. Now, the Constitution makes no mention of summits, but I'm wondering, Darrell West, who's the vice president and director of governance studies at the Brookings Institution, if this whole spectacle pageant summit, call it what you will, looks a little bit like Obama is convening a Supreme Court to overrule gridlock in the traditional Congress of the House of Representatives and the Senate. Darrell?
Well, he does hope to overturn gridlock because right now the two chambers are paralyzed and it's been very difficult to get the momentum to move forward. And I think the summit really provides an opportunity for Democrats to push the reset button. They've introduced some new elements. They have a proposal to give the federal government authority to block excessive insurance premiums. And I think Obama sees this as really his last chance to try and make this sale to the American public and to bring his own party together so they can actually pass health care reform.
Politically, Jonathan Cohn, senior editor for The New Republic, we spoke to you right at the top of the hour. Obama looks really great on television. There's really no dispute about that. But translating that great look on TV into concrete legislation has been a real problem. How does this get us farther down the road?
Well, I think there's two chief goals here. Number one, I think this, everybody says they want bipartisanship. So he's saying, all right, let's give people bipartisanship. Let's put us both in the same room, talk about our ideas. Now, I think I suspect that we will discover that, in fact, the two parties just have very different ideas here and that the Republicans in particular are at their core not interested in doing health care reform. If that happens, then I think what he wants to do is he wants the American people to see that, and he wants to let the American people know, what is in this bill. Because even though the bill itself is unpopular, when you break it down and tell people what's in it, remarkably, they like all the elements. So I think this is a chance to sit in front of the American people and say, look, this is what you said you wanted. I know it's been a messy process. I know you're turned off by the deal-making and all of that, but if we can pass this bill, we can actually do something to help you, and you won't have to worry about health care so much anymore.
Although implicitly, you're suggesting that the administration, having not done this up till now, maybe that's one of the key failings. Now, let's not talk about that for right this second, but Darrell West, Governance Studies, Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. Now, you're aware of some of the disputes and arguments over actually how to frame this entire summit, even how it's going to actually look. How are some of those arguments between Republicans and Democrats about the seating of the chairs indicate the sets of priorities behind the scenes here?
Well, the little things help to set the agenda for the big things. And I think what Democrats really need to do is to play to their strong suit, because even though some elements of healthcare reform are not very popular, people actually don't like the status quo either. They don't like health insurance companies raising premiums. We've seen some health companies in California propose 25 to 30% increases. That's just simply unacceptable when inflation is running 2 to 3% nationally. They need to basically explain how their insurance changes are going to help the average American get rid of pre-existing conditions and make the plight of Americans better than it is under the current status quo.
Well, but does that mean they're arguing about who's going to use PowerPoint, who's not, who's going to have charts, who's not, who's going to be sitting near the podium, lectern or no lectern?
The biggest argument actually was over who would actually attend the summit. President Obama actually invited Republican Senator Olympia Snowe because her own Republican leadership had not invited her. She ended up declining. And then Republicans invited a Democrat, Congressman Bart Stupak, who has been the author of this controversial anti-abortion amendment.
Right. And so that indicates that that clearly the bipartisan interest of the administration in talking to Olympia Snowe is one issue, and making sure that abortion question is in the debate is certainly an interest for the Republicans, right?
Absolutely, because each side understands the weaknesses of the opposition. So not only do they want to make their own case, they want to exploit some of the internal divisions that exist on the other side.
Jonathan Cohn, senior editor for the New Republic. Can I like hammer you with a possibly controversial premise here?
Please.
All right. The lesson supposedly of all administrations is when you get a mandate, you do the hard stuff first because you're not going to have much of a chance to do it later on in the administration when you get closer to re-election time and the congressional off-year elections, that sort of thing. Perhaps the lesson is just the obvious. It's just the opposite here, that if you take Clinton plus Obama, doing health care first is actually a huge mistake. What do you think about that?
Well, Clinton didn't do health care first, right? I mean, he did NAFTA, he did budget, and then he didn't even get to health care until very late in his first year. And there is this idea out there, well, you know, if only Obama had talked more about jobs, he would be better able to do health care later. Well, what that tends to miss is the fact that, you know, he did talk about jobs. He didn't do more about jobs because the Senate wouldn't let him do more about jobs.
Although there's an argument there. I mean, 17 Republicans crossed the line yesterday in the Senate vote on the jobs bill.
Well, funny, once they were able to break the filibuster to get the actual vote, 17 Republicans crossed the aisle. And I think there's a lesson about the Republican hypocrisy here, which is that they are trying to – you have senators voting to stop votes who say, no, 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 we can't have this vote, we can't have this vote. And then when the bill actually comes up and they're actually going to be held accountable for that vote, they want to be on the winning side. They want to be the ones who help to bring jobs to the American people. Substantively, I think that jobs bill we just passed is pretty small stuff. It's only $15 billion. It's a drop in the bucket. And that actually, you know, gets back to what I was saying before, which is that, he did jobs and he couldn't do more on jobs because the Senate wouldn't do more on jobs.
So maybe this is a way of finding small stuff in health care and getting that passed. So very, very quickly, Jonathan, and again, I get in trouble whenever I say that, but Jonathan Cohn, is this an infomercial or not? It sounds like you're saying it's not an infomercial.
I do not think so. Darryl, I think, in fact,
Darryl West, your view?
I agree. I think this is really the last opportunity to explain to the American public why we need to do this and why reforming health care is actually crucial for long-term economic competitiveness, because small businesses simply can't survive the current high cost of health care.
All right. So 6 hours perhaps well spent. Darryl West, Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, and Jonathan Cohn, Senior Editor for the New Republic. Thanks so much. So let's check in on stories we're following at 15 minutes after the hour.
Senate Democrats passed a $35 billion jobs bill yesterday. New York Senator Chuck Schumer says the bill will help.
It will do some good for the hundreds of thousands and perhaps millions who are looking desperately for work.
The bill includes state highway funding, and it now moves on to the House. A look at Toyota now. During hearings on Capitol Hill yesterday, Committee Chairman Adolphus Towns suggested taking some Toyota vehicles off the road.
If the Camry and the Prius were airplanes, they would be grounded.
But Toyota's president Akio Toyoda says
Toyota's car is safe.
Meanwhile, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood is urging Toyota owners to get their cars checked at dealers. The Senate voted to extend the Patriot Act for another year yesterday. No new privacy protections were added to the law.
In New York, more people allegedly connected to the plot to blow up the New York subway will appear in court today. Today's two defendants are reputed to be friends of Najib Ouzazi, who's already been sentenced to life in jail without parole for the plot. In Maryland, the authorities say the state will begin recognizing same-sex marriages. State Attorney General Douglas Gansler says gay couples who were married outside of the state will get the same rights as those married in Maryland. The judgment may be appealed in court. And finally, here's a little story we found this morning. California lawmakers are trying to make the Golden State a little cleaner when it comes to foul language, at least. The State Assembly is scheduled to vote on a resolution today that calls for a statewide cuss-free week to occur every year during the first week of March, when you really need it most, obviously.
What qualifies? I need a list of what qualifies as cussing.
Well, they're probably working on that in California. Those are look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, credit default swaps in Wall Street's collapse. The Factor, Louise Story is all over it.
Yo!
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
We've got some news takeouts for you, and first we're going to go to Greece. Now, credit default swaps were a factor in the financial crisis in the United States. That's basically when banks and hedge funds bet on the equivalent of a four-alarm fire. They're betting on whether or not these things are going to collapse, I guess. But it turns out that's also a factor in Greece's financial crisis. Louise Story, you've been all over this from the very beginning. You've uncovered some information about Greece and how credit default swaps have affected them.
Morning. So credit default swaps are a type of derivative, and you're right, it is a way to bet against an asset class. And the way it works is it's an insurance policy. So it's like a homeowner buys insurance on his house, and if the house, you know, catches on fire, he gets paid. And it's the same thing with the credit default swap. It allows a bank, for instance, can buy a credit default swap on Greece's debt. And if Greece doesn't pay the debt, then the bank gets paid. So it's an insurance policy, and a lot of it has sold, particularly in the last few months. People are buying more and more insurance on Greece's debt. The problem for Greece is the more people out there, banks and traders, who buy this protection, the more expensive it gets for Greece to borrow in the markets. So it can cause a downward spiral, and we saw this in the mortgage market.
You also have to wonder if whether or not they're kind of hoping that the Greece's financial crisis doesn't recover, because then they'll collect on their insurance policies. Louise Story is a finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times.
For our next takeout, we welcome back Jason Stallman, Olympics editor for our partner at The New York Times, online from Vancouver, Canada. So, Jason, first of all, it's my first conversation with you during the Olympics since I've been off for a little while. I've been watching the Olympics a fair amount since I can go to bed at a decent hour. You're having a great time out there, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, here's my question for you, though. I've actually been watching a fair amount of curling, okay? And it seems to me that the sport of curling, very, very popular in Canada and some other places in the universe, has really benefited from NBC's, like, proliferation of 50,000 cameras and different angles and all these sort of digital boxes on the screen. Do you think they're betting that with enough digital sort of largesse, curling can be a hugely popular sport?
I think they're wise to the notion that curling is somewhat of a novelty, and even if people are watching it only to laugh at it and to make fun of it and question whether these are truly athletes, it does seem to resonate every 4 years. It's just so different than anything we're used to watching.
Well, it looks like a video game up there, and for that reason, it seems much more accessible. Explain the rules again.
Well, you know what? I tell you what, I think it's more enjoyable if you don't truly understand the rules. But it's, you know, it's not unlike something like shuffleboard. They're sliding a stone down a sheet of ice, and they're, you know, aiming it toward a circular target. And it's a thinking man's game. It's a game of angles. And, you know, leave the questions of athleticism aside. It's fun to watch.
It is fun to watch. And who's favored for the gold?
Canada, yeah, runaway favorite, and they have a really compelling skip or team leader. His name's Kevin Martin. They call him K-Mart, and he absolutely does not look anything like what most people consider an Olympic athlete. 43 years old, balding, but he is rock star status in Canada.
Before we go, shifting to women's figure skating, can the Korean Kim Yuna, the favorite, who now has racked up such a huge score, be caught at this point?
Boy, it'll be really tough. You know, people are saying that she's going to have to fall down or something in order to be caught, but she's so superior that even if she falls, her technical components will probably make up for it. She could fall down and still win. However, her chief rival, Mao Asada of Japan, is planning to try to execute two triple axels. She's the first woman to execute a triple axel, one triple axel in the Olympics. She's going to try to pull off two in the free skate. If she does that, maybe it'll get close.
Well, maybe some suspense, but probably not much, but certainly a breathtaking skill and talent there on the ice with the Korean Kim Yuna. Jason Stallman, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jason, of course, is the Olympics editor for our partner, The New York Times, there in Vancouver, Canada.
And our last takeout is from you, and it's about technology. We talked about broadband internet yesterday and the government's plan to bring affordable high-speed hookups even to outlying rural areas. But Dwayne in the Detroit area called in to say the problem isn't just restricted to the countryside.
I have internet access, but only through satellite or by cellular broadband on USB connection to a laptop. And I'm just 15 minutes away from three major metropolitan areas, right off of a major highway.
Dwayne, not many choices for internet there, but the story about internet access is that it's so dependent on where you live.
My name is Randy Yocum, and I got my laptop, and I just steal Wi-Fi. I don't even pay for it. I can sit in the middle of my living room and steal five different Wi-Fis. That's the way everyone should do it. It should be free. There should be Wi-Fi in every corner.
I applaud your initiative, Randy. I do want to point out one thing, though, is that while you're stealing the Wi-Fi, everyone can't steal it because at some point, somebody has to pay for the Wi-Fi that you take.
Although eventually, I think he's right. It probably will be
eventually.
Free. It's probably going to be free. It's going to be so ubiquitous. So, you know, I was away for about a week, and I found this really sad story. These two radio hosts who were forced to eat expired food.
That was an interesting story, John.
What were you guys thinking?
It was totally fine. That food was fine. That was really interesting.
And this is about to figure out if you need to trust expiration dates.
Well, it
in
turns
produce.
Out they're arbitrary. There's no rules on how when to put these expiration dates on. The companies choose.
Well, I saw this comment from Ponto in Maryland. He writes, I once struggled over whether to buy shucked oysters from the bargain bin of a local store. It was very cheap, but I knew it might be a problem. I did buy them, and I made a superb oyster stew. I had no ill effects, but the tension of waiting out the oysters negated the value of the bargain. Have you waited out the food that you ate?
I feel fine.
Right. I don't know if I want to hear food poisoning roulette, although it is an intriguing sort of game. You can check it out at thetakeaway.org.
Coming up, White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel once said, never let a serious crisis go to waste. We're going to learn about, unfortunately, some scam artists who are taking that quote to heart in the wrong way. They're making money by targeting refugees from the tragic earthquakes in Haiti.
Rahm Emanuel is not profiting from people in
Haiti. That's not a fair comparison. We're saying that they took that the wrong direction, John.
Exactly.
That's the point.
Right.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, following the tragic earthquake in Haiti, thousands of people rushed to help. Millions gave money towards the relief effort. Some were trying to cash in on the disaster. We're going to talk about scams that surrounded the crisis in Haiti in just a few moments. First, here's some of the news stories that we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. We're getting more information now on how this morning's healthcare showdown will play out. The session will begin with an opening statement from President Obama, followed by remarks from a Republican and a Democrat selected by party leadership. The president will then moderate the six-hour discussion, all of it televised live, with only a break for lunch. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell is among the 22 lawmakers expected to attend.
If the White House wants real bipartisanship, then it needs to drop the proposal it posted Monday, which is no different in its essentials than anything we've seen before, and start all over.
The healthcare summit gets underway at 10 a.m. Eastern. And with that in the background, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius is asking the heads of five major health insurance companies to meet with her next month. She wants them to explain why their premiums are on the rise.
Toyota President Akio Toyoda was called on the Capitol Hill carpet yesterday. He didn't respond to questions about when his company knew about its safety problems, but he did apologize to the American people. New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo, meanwhile, says Toyota owners will now get several benefits in the state of New York if their car is being recalled.
Picking up the car, dropping the person off, rental car if you need it, transportation services, etc.
In other auto news, GM decided to scrap the Hummer brand after a deal with a Chinese firm fell through. What is it the BBC analyst said to us last hour? There's no market. There's no
no
one will buy them yet.
No expertise, no market.
Why did it fail? Oh my gosh, what a shock. A former New Orleans policeman has pleaded guilty to covering up for officers who allegedly killed two men in the chaos following Hurricane Katrina. The shootings happened 6 days after the storm when police are accused of firing at unarmed people crossing a bridge in search of food. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke gave his twice-a-year report to Congress yesterday, and he had this to say about interest rates.
The economic conditions are likely to warrant exceptionally low levels of the federal funds rate for an extended period.
Translation, no change in interest rates. Let's check the markets. Asian markets are down. European indices are mixed. Futures are down. The Dow gets underway at 10,374. The S&P opens at 1,105, and the NASDAQ starts trading at 2,235. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
After the Haiti earthquake, not everyone's response was charitable. A small minority decided to use it as an opportunity to make some money. Authorities in New York are investigating unscrupulous scam artists. They've been trying to provide phony legal services to Haitian immigrants. These are Haitian immigrants who want to take advantage of the United States government offer of a temporary protected status. With details, we've got the Manhattan District Attorney, Cyrus Vance Jr. He's a Manhattan District Attorney. He says his department has been getting complaints of scam artists charging Haitians exorbitant fees to apply for the immigration benefit. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste. How are you?
I'm doing well. Can you tell me, what's the scope of this? How many complaints has your office received, and what are the complaints detail?
Well, we received a number of complaints. I think the scope is enough to cause us concern, and particularly in light of the very difficult situation for the Haitian community. And the kinds of cases that are involved here are people who are preying upon Haitians because of their vulnerable situation. They include situations where someone pretends to be a lawyer who is not, someone who pretends to be a professional, like a government agent or real estate agent, offering to provide specific services, or a promise for a successful completion of documents, or simply someone who is unlicensed to practice law, engaging in the practice of law. The bottom line in all of this is that we have a very vulnerable group of people, and people are taking advantage of them in that time of need by falsely representing either who they are or what they can do, all motivated by profit.
Who are these people who are pretending to be lawyers or government agents? Are they American citizens? Are they Haitian?
It can be a mix. It can be a mix. Some members of the community, I think we're finding in our complaints that it is a mix. It's not dependent on any one particular individual.
Okay, that's not limited to New York, certainly. In Massachusetts, the Catholic Charities of Boston have also been running legal clinics to help Haitian immigrants there avoid these kind of scams. Margene Perhote is the organization's Director of Refugee and Immigration Services. Good morning, Margene.
Good morning, Celeste.
So you have actually held 5 information sessions for Haitians. Have you gotten complaints from your clients?
Yes, Celeste, we have. And to reiterate what Attorney Vance was saying, we are seeing the very same things here in the Boston region. And our immigration legal clinics have been set up to hopefully prevent Haitians from being taken advantage of. But we do have folks coming in and saying, this person around the corner said that I could get my family here for $5,000, and is this possible? And so we are very fortunate that we've got an amazing group of immigration attorneys to help prevent vulnerable Haitians from being taken advantage of.
So give me an example of that story that you just said. Someone offers to bring someone's family here for $5,000, and perhaps this person raises $5,000 and pays it to the person. Then what happens?
Well, unfortunately, what happens right now, Celeste, is there's not a lot of provisions within the law to bring families here quickly. So this is happening to Haitians who really want to get their families off the streets in Port-au-Prince. And so they're desperate. And then they find out that once they go to Haiti to try to bring their family out, there's no legal mechanism to do so. So they've spent all this money, and now their family is still trapped in Haiti, and now they have $5,000 less to support the family back home.
Okay, Margene Perhote, she's the Director of Refugee and Immigration Services. You heard the district attorney from Manhattan say that there's a mix among the people, these scam artists, these con artists. Are you finding the same thing there in Boston, that they're both a mix of Haitians and American citizens that are doing this?
Exactly the same. It's really not different. And this problem has been plaguing the immigrant community for years. It's not new to the Haitian situation. So it's always something that we're keenly aware of, because we often, as Catholic Charities, receive the person after they've been scammed by these nefarious individuals.
Cyrus Vance, what is the legal jurisdiction here? If someone is a Haitian immigrant, what powers do you have to prosecute them for this kind of thing?
Well, first of all, I think just to follow up on the comments from Catholic Charities, this isn't just about prosecution. I think the goal of all of us here is about how to prevent these from occurring in the first place. And that's why we, in fact, several weeks ago, working with our local borough president, Catholic Charities, a number of providers held a Help for Haitians seminar and meeting on a Saturday, where we brought not only our community and the federal government, but the Catholic Charities and other providers to both alert people to what was going on, help the Haitians know how they can legitimately apply for temporary protected status, you know, and provide essentially wraparound services both to alert and prevent the crime and help those who are in need appropriately document their applications. What basically we have here is simply fraud and theft. The jurisdiction is really straightforward. People are being conned. They are being told that someone can deliver a product or an event that is false. Money is being paid to do it, and it's a scam. It's really a fairly straightforward situation of theft.
Okay, that's Cyrus Vance. He's the Manhattan District Attorney. Margene Perhote of the Catholic Charities of Boston. How much should it cost a Haitian immigrant to apply for temporary protected status?
The average filing fee that they have to pay to the U.S. government is $470. And with so many generous providers, such as the Catholic Charities, both here and in New York, many agencies are doing this for free. So I encourage Haitians to look for the TPS clinics or workshops in their areas and get this service for free, because there's many, many dedicated attorneys who want to help Haitians and ensure that they're not being taken advantage of.
Okay, Margene Perhote is the Director of Refugee and Immigration Services for Catholic Charities. For those who may have encountered some suspect immigration services, we have a link on our website to the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. You can go to thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we're going to talk about transportation, about a new policy, new vision on transportation coming out of the White House.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Joining us now is Karen DeWitt, Albany reporter for our partner WNYC Radio, joining us from Albany. Good morning, Karen.
Morning, John.
So suddenly another upheaval in the David Paterson administration, an administration in the State House there in Albany that has seen its share of upheavals. First of all, what is the latest?
Well, as you said, it seems like another day, another upheaval. But this one, it's the third story the New York Times has published in their ongoing sort of an investigation of everything about the governor's professional and personal life. And this one seems, of all of them so far, to reflect the most poorly on the governor. It concerns one of the governor's top aides, David Johnson, who's a former driver and now a top advisor to the governor. His former girlfriend accused him in court of assaulting her last Halloween night. They had a fight at their home, allegedly. She went to court twice, and she complained both times that state troopers had tried to persuade her not to go through with the charges. And the Times also is reporting that Paterson himself called the woman one day before she was to appear in court seeking an order of protection. That was on February 8th, just a couple of weeks ago. And then the woman never showed up for her court date. The story also has Henry Corbett, who's the state police superintendent, confirming that a member of Paterson's security detail visited the woman. He says it's routine to do that in politically sensitive matters, and they merely wanted to offer her some options, like counseling. What's interesting is the state police don't have any jurisdiction in this case.
Well, I mean, you've got this huge double whammy. On the one hand, you've got the offensive crime allegation of domestic abuse, but then even more disturbing, particularly to a citizen of New York State, you have the governor's office using its sort of loyalty to employees as an excuse for marshaling the state police as a kind of personal political loyalty army. Is that really what's going on here?
Well, that's certainly what it looks like, and there have been questions surrounding the state police in the past being involved in similar kinds of behavior. You might remember Elliot Spitzer.
Sure.
former governor was accused of having the state police recreate travel records of one of his political enemies. The then Senate Majority Leader Joe Bruno became known as the Troopergate scandal, and it resulted in months of bad publicity for Spitzer. So I would assume that the same is going to happen to Patterson. This is a story that's not going to go away too soon.
Well, let's try to take the contrary view for just a moment, if we could. I mean, corporations routinely help employees who are having problems, even if they are of a criminal nature, and this is in no way to excuse domestic abuse. Is it possible that there's an explanation here that David Patterson was the governor was being appropriately loyal to an employee?
Well, you know, I mean, you're the governor of the state. You have a lot of power. You call somebody who's trying to press charges against the governor's aide, and I think it looks like there's, you know, it may not be the most proper way to behave. And I think the public gets a little nervous when the state police is used for some of these kinds of things.
And it looks bad. I think that's the takeaway. Where does it go from here, investigation-wise?
Excuse me?
Where does it go from here, investigation-wise?
Well, the Attorney General, Andrew Cuomo, is going to be investigating it. Patterson requested that late last night. What's very interesting about that is Cuomo, the most popular politician in New York State, is widely believed to announce soon that he's going to challenge Patterson to become governor this
politics, year. Politics and investigations, they always go together in the state of New York. Karen DeWitt, Albany reporter for our partner, WNYC Radio, about the latest upheaval in the David Patterson administration. Thank you, Karen.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, I'm Celeste Headlee, and I'm joined once again by John Hockenberry, who's been
good
away for
morning.
A week and a half.
I'm
welcome
back.
That's right.
I said I'd be back.
Over the past few years, at least, if you wanted transportation funding from the U.S. government, you had to prove it was shovel-ready. That means it had to be ready to go. You had the resources to start that project. Now, you also have to prove that the project is fair. We're going to tell you what that means in just a few moments. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. At the Olympics in Vancouver yesterday, in the end, the U.S. took a bronze in the women's short track speed skating. That's after South Korea was disqualified for interfering with a Chinese competitor. The South Korean women, thinking they'd won, celebrated together on the ice while the U.S. team looked on dejectedly. But then the disqualification was announced. Skater Kathleen Reuter says the medal is the result of hard work and a little luck.
We've been doing all the work to deserve this medal. So what was this race a little bit fluky? Maybe, but we did everything to deserve it. We were strong enough to be there.
The U.S. also took a bronze in women's bobsled.
A court in Turkey has charged more senior military officers with plotting to overthrow the Turkish government. It brings the number of those indicted now to 20. 6 weeks after that catastrophic earthquake in Haiti, power has been restored to nearly half of the capital, Port-au-Prince. A group of South American nations is committed to providing $100 million in infrastructure aid to Haiti. In Afghanistan, the Afghan government raised its flag over the southern Taliban stronghold of Marja today. Around 700 residents gathered to see a top government official sworn into office. Still, military are trying to mop up around the capital, so it's not completely a military victory. Mission not accomplished, I guess we should say. India and Pakistan have met for the first time since the deadly terror attack on the Indian city of Mumbai in 2008. The top Indian diplomat at the talks said they are the first step to rebuilding trust between the two countries. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
The Obama administration is changing the way it hands out federal money for transit projects. They're trying to speed up the pace of spending that money, but there's also a difference in vision in who deserves to get these funds. Here's Federal Transit Administrator Peter Rauguff.
An important part of our need to speed up this process involves quitting all the haggling between the federal government and these agencies about whether they follow and pass a very narrow criterion. Instead, we're going to recognize all of the benefits that transit projects provide like environmental benefits, mobility benefits, benefits to low-income communities, and that will hopefully speed up our process in getting these projects off the ground.
So we're going to take a look now at three different examples of how this change in the policy is actually going to show up in roads and other places around the nation. Joining us first is David Schultz. He's the transportation reporter for WAMU in Washington. And David, we should first explain, because sometimes federal funding policies can be very confusing, is that there is stimulus money that's funding transportation projects. There's so-called Tiger Grant projects. And what we're talking about here is totally different. That's a third thing.
Right. That's funding for the New Starts and Small Starts program that the federal government has announced last month.
So how is this different? How are these New Starts and Small Starts funds getting out in a different way?
Well, last month, the Obama administration sort of changed the funding criteria on projects that could be funded with federal money. Previously, the Bush administration had said it was only going to fund projects that shorten commutes for the most efficient use of money. Now the Obama administration has taken into account livability issues, and it defined that as economic development opportunities and environmental benefits. So that plays into to their funding criteria now.
So it also has to help low-income communities. It has to be environmentally sound. They're trying to make it nice. It has to be nice.
Right. Well, that's one way of putting it. It has to be. It's not just a narrowly focused funding criteria. They're going to look at many different aspects of the project to see whether or not it deserves federal funding.
Okay, you talked to this particular bus rider in Maryland and her young daughter. They don't seem very excited to ride the bus, and maybe transportation funds will change that. But here's what they had to say.
It's very dangerous, and with my daughter here, it's more. With younger children, it's very dangerous.
She says it's dangerous to ride the bus, and they're hoping to change that.
Yeah, there. She is a bus rider in Prince George's County, Maryland, which is there are parts of Prince George's that are very economically disadvantaged, and one of the funds that is being applied for here in Prince George's is a $15 million grant to improve bus stops in that area. So that would go towards better signage, new shelters, better lighting, sidewalk improvements, and things that while they don't necessarily shorten commutes, it makes riding a bus more attractive to someone who might not necessarily want to do that.
Okay, that's what's going on around Washington, D.C. There's stuff going around the country, though, and we want to go now to Laura Yuen. She's a St. Paul reporter for Minnesota Public Radio. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning.
What is the project that you're getting funds for in Minneapolis?
Well, this is called the Central Corridor Project. It's an 11-mile light rail transit route connecting the downtowns of St. Paul and Minneapolis. And this announcement basically made it possible to include three extra stations along this line. And that issue has just been a huge hot-button issue for the communities who would be served by this line. Previously, the three extra stations would not be possible because it's kind of through the what's called the cost-effectiveness index out of skew. And
It was too expensive to make these lines that just serve these underserved communities.
That's right.
And they called it a civil rights concern because there were a lot of Asians and African Americans who said, look, we need light rail service like anyone else does.
Right. I mean, some folks felt that this line was just being built as kind of a pass-through for the rich, you know, commuters who were just trying to get from one city to the next.
Okay, and you're now getting almost $8 million for these three extra stations. That's Laura Yuen, a St. Paul reporter for Minnesota Public Radio. And we're going to go stop at one more place where this new policy on funding is making a difference, and that is in Oakland, California. Guillermo Mayor joins us. He's a senior staff attorney with Public Advocates, a nonprofit law firm and advocacy agency in Oakland, California. Good morning, Guillermo.
Good morning.
So explain to me the story of the BART Oakland Airport connector fight, the fight over this.
Sure. Well, this is the first time that the federal government pulls stimulus funding from a project because local officials did not take the necessary steps to ensure that the project was fair to low-income and minority populations. And at issue is a 3-mile connector between the Oakland Airport and a BART station, or the Bay Area Rapid Transit District, which is the commuter rail service here in the San Francisco Bay Area. The project would replace an existing bus shuttle that connects the BART system to the airport with a $500 million rail link. And the concern over this project is that It does not provide any benefits to East Oakland residents that are overwhelmingly African-American, Latino, Asian, and low-income. What the project does is that it charges a $6 fare to get to the airport and back, so $12 round trip. It includes no intermediate stops so that East Oakland residents can access the many jobs along the three-mile route. And it really has not included their input. This project has significantly changed, and the community has been left out.
So this was another chance where you, I mean, this is another situation in which you argued that they were creating a pass-through situation for higher-income people. You fought against this, and the Obama administration sided with you.
That's correct. It was unprecedented. You rarely see this kind of agency enforcement of civil rights, and it's great news for it signals a major shift in civil rights enforcement, not only at the Federal Transit Administration, but we think at other federal agencies.
All right, so you're going to get a service from the members, the residents of East Oakland, all the way to the airport, which will include stops along the way so they can get to their jobs.
Well, that's what we want, is a project in the end that includes benefits for the community. Whether it ends up being a rail link or an improved bus link is yet to be known.
Okay, Guillermo Mayor is a senior staff attorney with Public Advocates. It's a nonprofit law firm and advocacy agency. We also spoke with David Schultz, transportation reporter for her station WAMU in Washington, D.C., and Laura Yuen, St. Paul reporter for Minnesota Public Radio. Thank you to all of you.
Our conversation on transportation continues tomorrow, and right there you can hear some suggestions of real Brown versus Board of Education social justice issues bound up in transportation access in urban areas. It's a really interesting issue. We need your reporting to get our conversation started on transportation tomorrow. We're looking at gas prices and commuting costs, how they're tied to the foreclosure crisis. How has increasing gas prices or bus fares or train tickets hit your wallet specifically? Tell us the price of your commute at 877-8MYTAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. We also want your suggestions for who had a good week and who had a bad week with our friends at The Week magazine. We tally up everyone's luck each Friday, but we want to hear yours too. You know how to reach us, 877-8MYTAKE, or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org. And with the President's Healthcare Summit starting today, we want you to watch and give us your reaction, okay? I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.